today on Against the Grain, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, the New Deal's public works projects, the UN's inception, and San Francisco's role in it. I'm C.S. Song. Gray Brecken, founder and project scholar of The Living New Deal, brings his expertise to bear on these and other matters coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Gray Brecken has a fondness for the New Deal. Well, that's an understatement about a scholar and writer who's devoted a significant chunk of his life to investigating and getting the word out about what the New Deal was and what was built, crafted, painted, sculpted, and otherwise created under its many public works programs. You may be familiar with some of those programs and agencies: the Works Progress Administration, or WPA, the Civilian Conservation Corps, or CCC, the Public Works Administration, or PWA, the Civil Works Administration, or CWA. To mark the 70th anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Charter in San Francisco, Gray Brecken spoke at an event sponsored by Shaping San Francisco. Well, it's now been 75 years since the charter was signed, back in 1945, but Gray's comments about the New Deal and the Roosevelts and the UN, when I came across them recently, seemed to me as edifying and relevant as ever. So today we present edited portions of Gray's remarks, made in December 2015. Gray Brecken is an historical geographer and the author of Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. He is project scholar of the Living New Deal, which works to inventory, map, and publicize the achievements of the New Deal and its public works across all 50 states. Now, as you'll soon realize, Gray, at the event, presented and made reference to a number of visuals, but in many cases, after referring to an illustration, he goes on to describe it in adequate detail for our purposes. Let's go now to Gray Brecken, speaking here about FDR.
March 4th, 1933, this guy is inaugurated in Washington, D.C. At that time, he made the famous statement, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Probably his most famous statement. And good to remember that somebody once said that, now that we're all marinated in fear 24/7, all the time, you know, and it just keeps getting worse. What we really got in 1933 with the election and the inauguration was a twofer. We got Franklin and we got Eleanor. What an amazing pair. Very few countries get as lucky as to have one of those at one time, but we got two. Here's Eleanor serving food to the poor. She got her start, although she was wealthy. She, of course, was a distant cousin of Franklin and a Roosevelt, but she got her start early in the 20th century working in settlement houses on the Lower East Side, and as did many of the people who worked in the New Deal with whom the Roosevelts surrounded themselves. So she was no stranger to the pathologies of poverty. She knew it very well, and when she started dating Franklin at one point, as she recounts in her autobiography, she took a sick child back to its home in a tenement and had Franklin come up with her, and recounts that Franklin afterwards was white as a sheet when they went back to the sidewalk and said, "My God, I had no idea that people could live that way." Because, of course, he'd never experienced it before in his very privileged position. Eleanor had, by doing the kind of work that she did and exposed to the kind of people that she had been, sometimes her advice was not altogether welcome by her husband, but, you know, she was always there to push him to the left, even when he didn't particularly want to be pushed that way. I like this fresco in Coit Tower. by John Boardman Howard, because it captures the anger that people forget was afoot in the land in 33 when Roosevelt came to office. Somebody said to him at that time, your programs had better work or will be a one-term president. And he said, if my programs don't work, I will be the last president. And that's true. We were coming very close to revolution or civil war at that time because, again, what people forget is that so much of what we had until recently to make sure that we would never have a Great Depression again is the product of the New Deal, the social safety net, and things such as the SEC and the FDIC, and et cetera. Those agencies which have since been captured by their erstwhile enemies. But at that time, the country had been in ever-deepening depression for over almost 5 years, and nobody knew where the bottom was. And when Roosevelt came in, the banks were going down like dominoes, and there was no FDIC, so if you had your life savings in a bank and it closed from malfeasance, embezzlement, whatever, you lost everything. You had nothing to fall back on. So it was getting pretty dire at that time. Roosevelt hit the ground running with the 100 days at the beginning of the New Deal. He had a rubber stamp Congress at that time, and they gave him pretty much everything that he wanted. Those 100 days were just an amazing period. 15 major pieces of reform legislation, including the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was his own idea. Now, these are civilian work administration workers working. CWA was the forerunner of the more famous WPA, and it was created by Roosevelt by executive order in November of 1933 because he realized that if there wasn't an emergency work relief program, literally millions of Americans would starve and freeze that winter. And so he created it and put it under his sort of right-hand man, Harry Hopkins, who had also worked in settlement houses and who would then be the head of the WPA as well, too. These are hundreds of men working to create a park in San Francisco, which most people don't go to. It's Bayview Park, down in above Candlestick Point. Here is a rock wall, Jake Sigg there leaning against it. We went up, he showed it to me, and that's all CWA work. Beautiful rock work, which sort of identifies these things as WPA or CWA or CCC. They just did gorgeous rock work at that time. So at the same time that this guy was being inaugurated in the United States, this guy was being inaugurated in Germany. This was another option, another way that we might have gone too, because so many nations in Europe were going in this direction. The United States was kind of anomalous in that it headed in the other direction. This doesn't normally happen when you have severe economic downturns such as that one and the one we've recently had and probably are still in at this point. Usually you move to the right, but in the United States it was a bit different, largely because of the unique personality of the Roosevelts. Now, here's the League of Nations, which had been created after the First World War, the Great War in Geneva. And Roosevelt remembered this because he had been the Undersecretary of Navy at that time. He had been working and was great friends with President Wilson. And he always thought that this was the model and what should have stopped the movement towards fascism and war in the 1930s, but was ineffective, largely because of the isolationists within the United States who made sure that the U.S. didn't join the League of Nations. So it was quite ineffective. But Roosevelt never quite gave up on this. In April 1932, before Roosevelt was elected, National Geographic magazine ran a cover story out in San Francisco. Fed on gold dust and fattened by sea trade, the Pioneer Village becomes a busy world port. Well, I love that title, Out in San Francisco. That's so East Coast, you know. So there it is, that, you know, that pretty city out there, way out there. No need to take it terribly seriously, but they, you know, they gave it a... they gave it a fair shot. It's got some great black and white photos in it. Here's an aerial view looking down towards the San Francisco Peninsula. You get to see the bay, the Golden Gate. Here's some of the photographs. You can see the Bay Bridge hasn't been built yet. That's a New Deal project built by the Public Works Administration. So the bay was kind of uncluttered at that time, as was the skyline. It must have been an amazing time to be there because of these, you know, these beautiful deco skyscrapers by George Kellam and Tim Pfluger with the ornament, and the way that they served as a kind of counterpoint to the hills behind them. And you had these views down to the bay. You can still see it in some of the films, those period films of Alfred Hitchcock, like Vertigo. Before the monster skyscrapers started going up. It's funny how nobody ever talks anymore about what those skyscrapers are actually doing to the sense of possibility that seemed to exist in San Francisco at that time, when you had these tremendous views down every street, most of which are now gone, basically blocked by walls of granite and steel and glass. It wound up with this photograph of my alma mater, the University of California, with the main axis aimed at the Golden Gate. I write about this in Imperial San Francisco, and the hill behind it, unencumbered by the laboratories, which would soon begin to produce an invention, which largely came out of the minds of, or the partnership of these two guys who arrived in 1929, 6 months apart, Ernest O. Lawrence and J. Robert Oppenheimer, the theoretical physicists and the engineer who together would create an invention that would, of course, warp and change the history of the world. Well, the New Deal did revolutionize the Bay Area. There is the Bay Bridge, you know, one of the largest of the projects, probably the largest New Deal project in the Bay Area, our equivalent of the Triborough Bridge in New York, which is also a PWA project. Well, I suppose the biggest project really would be Treasure Island, built out in the Bay, 400 acres on Yerba Buena Shoals, on the product of the WPA and the PWA working together, $8.5 million given by the federal government to build this artificial island in the middle of the bay, ostensibly for a World's Fair, but really for one of the city's two New Deal airports. Here is the plan for the World's Fair, the Treasure Island World's Fair, most of which the buildings were to be temporarily torn down immediately after the fair, and then it would be converted into the city's Trans-Pacific Airport. The Treasure Island Fair is very different than the fair 24 years previously, the Panama Pacific Exposition that's being celebrated almost ad nauseum now. It had triumphal arches and courts and everything like the PPIE did, but what's missing is all of the symbols of racial hierarchy and of conquest, which if you read the PPIE is pretty disturbing when you get into it. That horrible statue, the end of the trail, which became such a an American icon, which is, when you think about it, the most successful sentimentalization of genocide ever created. But the Treasure Island Fair was different. I've actually come to like it better because of that, because what it was trying to do was to create a syncretic culture in which all of the various cultures around the Pacific would learn from one another and create a new kind of culture, a Pacific culture. It's not about conquest. It's not about racial hierarchy. Quite the contrary.
That's Gray Brecken. He gave a talk to mark the 70th anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Charter in San Francisco. It's now been 75 years. Brecken is an historical geographer, an author, and project scholar of the Living New Deal. His books include Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin, and Farewell Promised Land, Waking from the California Dream, the latter produced in collaboration with the photographer Robert Dawson. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's return to more of Gray Brecken's talk about the New Deal and the United Nations.
Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo came to San Francisco a number of times. They had friends here, and they had tremendous influence on the local artists here. Here's Diego working on what I think is one of his masterpieces, the Pan-Pacific mural, which is now down at City College. Now, if you haven't seen it, you should. It's just incredibly complex. You could just stand there for hours. If you're lucky, Will Mines, the former professor who is the custodian of it, can just guide you through it. But it's just incredibly rich. And it shows the two continents of the Americas and how they each have their own strengths and how they could learn from one another, the people of them. But it's really a celebration of the work that people do. Well, this is another WPA fresco. This is actually at the Beach Chalet out in Golden Gate Park. And again, there's no racial hierarchy. In fact, these are the various races around the Pacific, and there's no judgment given on it. And that, I think, was quite deliberate. They had actually learned something from the New Deal. This is one of the remaining statues from the Treasure Island Fair, which is out front of the old administration building. And her features are deliberately ambiguous. They are of no particular race. They're of all races. This figure is on one of the hangars, and it represents how the world will be brought together and made more peaceful by instant or rapid communication and transportation. This is the Pan Am Clipper taking off from the cove, actually, on its way across the Pacific, and this would begin to shrink the Pacific. That was the idea, and people would learn from one another. And of course, San Francisco would benefit from that because of all the business that it would bring to San Francisco. Unfortunately, that's not the way things turned out, of course. The Pearl Harbor was bombed, the United States immediately entered the war, and this was going on in Europe and also over Japan with the firebombing of the cities. The total obliteration of entire cities, Tokyo, in which 120,000 Japanese died in one night of firebombing. It's interesting. Mumford said, in the act of dying, the Germans transmitted their virus to the would-be victors. And he was speaking of the crime of aerial firebombing, and then, the culmination at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So many buildings were destroyed, so much housing was destroyed, that there was an immediate problem afterwards for the survivors of homelessness. People had lost everything that they owned. And what's interesting is that we see the same thing in our streets every day, and we come to take it for granted, actually. This is what I call normative savagery, the ever-growing numbers of homeless on the streets of San Francisco because they no longer can afford housing in this most opulent and successful of cities. So we go back to UN Plaza and the inscription engraved on that granite. And what I have been doing in the Living New Deal is looking at the lost ethical language of New Deal public works. The public works of the New Deal are trying to speak to us in a very different language than the one we've become used to as neoliberalism has triumphed in the last 30 or 40 years. It was a very different value system. Here it is, actually. This is Larry Halprin's real masterpiece, the Franklin Roosevelt Memorial on the Tidal Basin in Washington, D.C. This is from his second inaugural address. The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little. Well, that's something you haven't heard in quite some time, certainly not from this president. And it's a fundamentally Christian statement. And the Roosevelts were practicing rather than professing Christians. They believed that it was their duty to help those less fortunate, even though they had both grown up in great luxury and privilege. In that speech, Roosevelt also said, "I see one-third of a nation ill-clad, ill-housed, and ill-fed." He didn't talk about the middle class. He actually talked about poverty. Again, something you don't hear about today. And that one-third of a nation was living in poverty. Now it's about half, actually. And especially what's really disgraceful is that we have the highest level of child poverty in the world of any developed nation. And those children will be permanently damaged by the experience of childhood poverty. But what happened with this is that the Federal Theater Project, which was a part of the WPA, actually dramatized that as one of their living newspapers, turned it into a play, which was very popular. It was performed all over the country. Hundreds of thousands of people saw this play. I was lucky enough to see it myself, actually. Not at that time. I'm not quite that old, although I feel it sometimes. But this is a still, actually, from the opening of One Third of a Nation. It opens with a tenement house fire on the Lower East Side, which happened quite often, actually. It's pretty difficult to stage this, but I saw it staged, actually. An off-Broadway company in New York put this play on a few years ago. 11 actors played 110 parts. The Federal Theater plays had huge casts to employ as many people as possible. But they did a terrific job. Right in the middle of it is an amazing thing. You'd love this. This is so Henry George. they put a rectangle on the stage. And the guy over here is probably somebody like Alexander Hamilton. It's one of the people who got in on the ground floor of Manhattan. He owns that rectangle. And as time goes on, more and more people begin piling into that and fighting over that rectangle. And of course, he becomes richer and richer, which is, as Henry George said, how you can have the coexistence, almost the necessary coexistence, of great wealth and great poverty in the same place, because of land monopoly. I wish we could restage this play, although it's very New York specific, but the same thing would apply here. As William Randolph Hearst wrote to his dad when he was 22, advising him to get out of mining and into real estate, he said to Senator Hearst, "Every atom of humanity added to the struggling mass means another figure to the landlord's bank account." Well, his dad didn't need any urging. He just was investing in real estate everywhere, as did Willie. So in 1941, in his third inaugural address, Franklin Roosevelt enunciated the famous four freedoms, which are carved on the wall at the FDR Memorial. You know these. In addition to the freedom of speech and of worship of the First Amendment, he added, "We must have freedom from want and from fear, and they are inextricably connected together. They are not separate. They are absolutely connected. If people have want, they have fear." As he said in his Second Bill of Rights speech, "Necessitous men are not free men." The Four Freedoms became so famous that Norman Rockwell did this famous series of paintings, which were in this Saturday Evening Post. So people saw these, and it really stirred patriotism. The Four Freedoms Park has just been built for $44 million on the southern tip of Roosevelt Island in the East River, facing the UN. And here it is, carved on this huge block of granite. The idea of the Four Freedoms and of the United Nations, which I'm finally going to come to, is that it is a new deal for the world. That the New Deal, which had actually gotten the United States out of the Depression and had saved people from despair and the fear, which Roosevelt talked about at the beginning, had to be extended everywhere to the world if we were going to avoid another war like the one he was fighting at that time, which he did not want to fight, but he had to. Here again, the FDR Memorial. "I have seen war. I have seen war on land and sea. I have seen blood running from the wounded. I have seen the dead in the mud. I have seen cities destroyed. I have seen children starving. I have seen the agony of mothers and wives. I hate war." Both of them, Eleanor and Franklin had seen it during the Great War. They had seen it when they were in Europe. More than an end to war, we want an end to the beginning of all wars. But how do you do that? Well, you have to have a United Nations in order to make sure that we would never have another war like the Second World War again. So let's go back to that National Geographic magazine. Why did they have it in San Francisco? Well, largely because of this man. This was Roosevelt's Secretary of State, Edward Stettinius, quite a remarkable man, actually. And when he and Roosevelt and Hopkins were in Yalta to talk with Churchill and Stalin during the war, to begin to decide what we're going to do after the war, he had a dream, he said, and he dreamt that all the nations of the world would come together in San Francisco. And he loved San Francisco. And so largely because, we think, because of Stettinius's dream, they decided to have it in San Francisco, even though it's out there. And so here's Franklin talking with Stettinius and with others of his cabinet around him. He was really looking forward to going to San Francisco and attending the opening ceremonies of the UN, what would be the UN. He says here that in a conversation he had with his good buddy Cornelius Vanderbilt Jr., that he was really looking forward to it. He would stay in a battleship in San Francisco Harbor and attend the ceremonies. But first he was going to go down to Warm Springs for a little R&R, because he was, well, as you can see, he's incredibly drawn. This is a dead man walking. He was losing his energy. He had heart disease, and the strain of going to Yalta had really taken it out of him. On April 12, 1945, he died suddenly in this bed of a massive cerebral hemorrhage. This is in the little White House at Warm Springs. The world went into mourning because this man, who had been president for over 12 years, and many people knew no other president than Roosevelt, and suddenly he was gone. He was the true father of the country. So, of course, the country, the world went into mourning because of his absence. The UN convened, the 50 nations that would become the foundation of the United Nations, convened in the Opera House on April 25th, 1945, a little over 10 days after Roosevelt's death, opening with a moment of silence for the man whose idea it was, who wanted it to happen, but who was not there. Truman did not attend the opening ceremonies. He attended the end of it. The charter was ratified, as I said, on the 25th in the Opera House, and then the next day was signed on the stage of Herb's Theater. Now, the artist Anton Refrigier of Woodstock, New York, happened to be sent to San Francisco at that time by Fortune magazine to make drawings of it, which appeared in Fortune magazine, and they're wonderful. He captured the excitement of the city as it hosted these strange and exotic people from all over the world and imagined itself to be the new Geneva or perhaps even the capital of the world.
The voice of Gray Brecken, historical geographer, author, and project scholar of the Living New Deal, which works to inventory, map, and publicize the achievements of the New Deal and its public works around the U.S. Gray was speaking at a 2015 event sponsored by Shaping San Francisco, a participatory community history project documenting and archiving overlooked stories and memories of San Francisco. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Let's go to more of this event. We pick up with Gray talking about the competition over the siting of the UN headquarters.
Unfortunately for San Francisco and all the other competing cities, that's not where Nelson Rockefeller and Robert Moses wanted it to be. The UN committee also said they didn't want it to be near Wall Street because it might get dominated by Wall Street. So Rockefeller and Moses made sure that it was on the East River on 14 acres. So they demolished a bunch of buildings, and there it is, so that it can't expand, and it's very close to Wall Street. Well, on August 6, 1945, this invention was demonstrated and made public over the city of Hiroshima. And 3 days later, of course, another one went off over Nagasaki. And I think that Roosevelt was one of the reasons he was so insistent on a United Nations was because he was in the know. After all, he had authorized the Manhattan Project. So even before this was demonstrated, he knew that the next world war would be the last world war because of this invention. Here is Hiroshima afterwards. It looks very much like the firebomb cities, except it's really radioactive. On March 2nd, 1946, Lewis Mumford wrote a really important essay in the Saturday Review, saying it's titled, "Gentlemen, You Are Mad." And he's referring to the doctrine, I believe it, even at that time, of mutually assured destruction. But he said that the possession of these weapons was not only mad in itself, but would drive their possessors mad because of the hubris that they gave. So it really ushered in a new era of fear, and particularly as the weapons kept getting bigger and bigger, largely because of the two shadow campuses of my university, which it never talks about, at Los Alamos and Livermore, which were set up to compete with one another to make sure that they got larger and larger and that the money kept flowing from Washington into these bomb production facilities. So because of these and because of the onset of the Cold War, we have spent, well, Brookings Institution in 96 estimated $5.5 trillion on the nuclear weapons program. Nobody really knows how much we've spent because so much of it is black budget. But I've heard estimates up to $11 trillion. And that has very much to do with this, with why we can't have another New Deal, because, of course, so much of our budget is actually going into weaponry and the preparation for Armageddon rather than into the social services that the New Deal could devote to alleviating problems such as this, or this, the rotting infrastructure of our country. But at my university, the connection with nuclear weapons is never discussed. Well, finally, why don't we know any of this stuff? Why don't we think about the United Nations as one of the great moments in San Francisco's history? Well, I think part of it is because FDR himself, to a large extent, has been erased, not just metaphorically, but in some cases quite literally. This is a New Deal building. It is built by the Public Works Administration, the old Rincon Annex post office at Spear and Mission Street. This is the artist who won the competition to decorate the lobby with 28 murals representing the history of San Francisco. It's old Anton Refregier come back to San Francisco to do this. The project had been okayed before the war broke out. It was delayed. He was here for the UN charter signing, then went back to Woodstock, New York, comes back to work on this, his masterpiece. The Rincon murals are, I think, the greatest New Deal artwork in the country. Unlike the first New Deal projects, the Coit Tower murals, which were panels given to individual artists, and that's the same with many of the post office murals around the country, here he was able to work out a narrative of which begins with an Indian, an individual, and goes around the lobby in 28 panels, winding up with the signing of the UN Charter. On the way, lots of stuff happens. It's a history seen through the eyes of labor and of also of various races. This is the shipyard, the Marin shipyard, actually, the arsenal of democracy. And at the very end of the lobby, he intended the face of Roosevelt. There's a triptych. On the left is the war. It is the Allies facing off against the Axis. It shows the burning of the books, the concentration camps, the muzzling of people, and then on this side, Roosevelt's greatest vision, a New Deal for the world, the signing of the UN Charter in San Francisco, and in between, Roosevelt. And in Refregier's papers, which are back in Washington, he said, "I wanted to dedicate this mural cycle to Roosevelt, and I wanted his face I wanted to use the face of the man who had come back from Yalta. It was a face tired, sensitive, and extremely beautiful. And you can see, actually, the haggard look of it. It's not the young Roosevelt, the powerful Roosevelt. This is the man towards the end of his life. And the freedom of speech, four freedoms are in the back. Well, the big chill was setting in Washington during the Truman administration, and his new supervisor said, take that face out. And he fought it for 8 months, aided by labor unions and artists and various others. It was a national cause célèbre, but finally he had to give in. And this is what you see today. You see the four freedoms. It was a compromise, and we didn't really know whether he had actually painted it until we found a home movie that the Refregi family apparently has, and it shows that Roosevelt's face is under there. So I'm hoping that at some point maybe we can actually do it the way that he wanted it to be. This is what Refregi wrote. The fight was lost. It was a good fight that involved people in all walks of life, labor, professionals, artists, and just plain people. But the climate was changing. It was necessary to erase the image of Roosevelt and his plans for coexistence and peace, hope of friendship with the Soviet Union, in order to see the American people on the Cold War. We have nothing to fear but fear itself, said President Roosevelt. America is now a country of fear. So, you know, this mural cycle and what happened to it becomes only more timely now that we are a nation of fear. Well, back to the Four Freedoms Park. It enunciates, this is the text, and what we forget is that after every freedom, he said, everywhere in the world. This is Roosevelt himself.
In our day, certain economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of state or race or creed. Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom, freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad, the right of every family to a decent home, the right to adequate medical care, and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, the right to a good education.
This is his fourth inaugural, and he was dead serious about this, so dead serious that he had this filmed, and historians didn't think this existed until Roger Moore team discovered it, actually. And why was he so insistent on this? Well, of course, because he's fighting a war at that time. And this is why he's so serious about that.
All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world.
So you can see how the New Deal and this last enunciation of these essential rights is totally integrated with the vision that he had of the United Nations and of aborting war before it ever started again. Eleanor carried this on after his death, of course. She was appointed by Truman as the delegate to the committee that came up with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948. Here she is with it. And it essentially codifies the Second Bill of Rights as the rights of all human beings in the world. This is, again, the FDR Memorial and a statement by Roosevelt. The structure of world peace cannot be the work of one man or of one party or of one nation. It must be a peace which rests on the cooperative effort of the whole world. That is the same statement at UN Plaza, carved in much smaller letters at this site of just disgusting poverty and despair. At that time, the Chronicle carried an op-ed by Paul Kennedy, "Does the United Nations have a future?" And I think that that should be reframed. The men at Los Alamos had played a game called Tickling the Dragon's Tail, in which they would bring two halves of plutonium together to see what would happen. And what happens is, as it approaches critical mass, it apparently starts to spark and sends out a tremendous burst of radioactivity, which in one case essentially killed every person in the room, but they fortunately pulled them away before they were able to detonate an explosion. Well, the point is that we're playing that game every day, but people aren't thinking about it. Again, like Roosevelt and the new United Nations, they have essentially been made to forget that those weapons are still waiting to be used. And we have headlines like this all the time, or an op-ed like this by a general who is in control of the nuclear arsenal, who says that we'd better think about it because hackers every day are trying to break in to the UN, nuclear arsenal, and someday they will succeed.
Gray Brecken is his name. You're listening to edited portions of a talk about the New Deal and the Roosevelts and the United Nations and nuclear armaments at an event in San Francisco. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain. And we go now to excerpts from the question and answer portion of the event. This clip begins with Gray talking about another New Deal project built in San Francisco and about the numbers of people engaged to work on it and other projects. Then you'll hear a comment and question from Chris Carlson, co-founder and co-director of Shaping San Francisco.
The WPA built the Cow Palace, for example, and I read a memoir by one of the local nobility around here, you know, who he hated the New Deal because he said, you know, they could have used heavy machinery for that. Instead, they squandered money by employing all these guys doing it as hand labor. Well, he didn't get the point. That's exactly that was the policy to do that. And I've got a photograph of the CWA workers building Lake Merced Boulevard. And it looks like some scene out of a Cecil B. DeMille movie where, you know, hundreds of extras. Well, that was very deliberate. You know, give as many people jobs as possible, spread the money around. And now instead, you know, the favorite word of the techies around here is disruption, which means basically kill jobs, you know, change everything. And there's, you know, no talk about, well, what do you do with people who can't find work anymore? Or can't afford housing. Well, they thought about that kind of stuff at that time. The WPA was a bit different than the PWA. The WPA basically was shove money at the bottom and give lots of people work. They got checks directly from the federal government. PWA under Harold Ickes was trickled down. That was basically give companies contracts to build the big projects like the bridges and the dams and stuff. And that wasn't nearly as productive of jobs because, of course, those companies like Bechtel and Kaiser had a vested interest in automation and not employing a lot of people. But they did build a lot of stuff. But it was, you know, I mean, it's what we didn't see when Obama came in. He just used the trickle-down model. He didn't force money in at the bottom, which would have gotten us out of it much faster.
I have a kind of an odd question, sort of more inviting you to speculate, but why was Roosevelt not a socialist? Why did he not go fully on to a more formal agenda of promoting a socialist world? I mean, it seems like his ideas were close to that, but obviously he was always, I mean, I know at one point Francis Perkins, his labor secretary, sends him a cable in the middle of the general strike in San Francisco, nothing to worry about, conservative union leaders are in charge.
Yeah.
And so clearly she's speaking to an interest that he had about controlling labor, right? It wasn't like this open season, like let's let the workers run their own lives and let's reorganize how we produce the world so that we don't even have to be concerned about unemployment because there's enough of everything for everybody. Those kinds of basic questions that a socialist world might head towards, or might more likely have done so in the 1930s than they would even today. What's your reckoning? You've thought about Roosevelt an awful lot. Why was he not a socialist? Why did he stay committed to capitalism as an economic model?
He went pretty far compared with what we've got now.
Well, granted.
And I think he would have liked to have gone farther, but I mean, he wasn't completely without constraints. I mean, because there's a recent book, I've forgotten what it's called, but anyway, it talks about how he was constrained by the conservative Southern Democrats, particularly on issues of race. Mm-hmm. And his wife is always urging him, especially to move on, well, civil rights and lynching. And he can't do that. I mean, he's a master politician. But as he said, you know, if I do that, I will destroy the Democratic Party. He left that up to LBJ. But I think he's moving in that direction. I mean, you know, your criticism is that of the left. There are a lot of people, like Howard Zinn was very critical mm-hmm. of FDR because he said he didn't go far enough and he basically short-circuited the revolution that otherwise would have happened. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways Zinn was kind of a romantic. It wouldn't have been a picnic. It would have been a second civil war. But Lauren Coodley found this letter that Cornelius Vanderbilt wrote to Upton Sinclair after Roosevelt's death. He had seen Roosevelt just before he died, and he said Roosevelt told him that when this war is over, I'm going to clip the wings of the international bankers so that they will never be able to fly again, meaning that they would never be able to create another war like the one that they were doing at that time. And When you hear that second Bill of Rights speech, it sure sounds like socialism to me.
Yeah.
But I think he really did believe that you could have a kinder, gentler capitalism, which to my mind is talking about a vegetarian tiger.
We skip ahead now to Gray Brecken commenting on what made FDR such a popular and admired figure.
I keep coming back to his charisma. He was an extraordinary character. He was... he was able to project the figure of father of the country, and he was obviously aristocratic. He didn't use words like folks. He would never say something like, we tortured some folks, you know, offhandedly. He was definitely an aristocrat, and yet he cared. He obviously cared for people less fortunate because he'd had this own terrible tragedy himself, which taught him humility. He went through this kind of dark valley in getting polio. And Francis Perkins, as Secretary of Labor, said that's what really taught him compassion for other people. And I think he projected that. And I think, you know, he did have this, as I say, both of them and the people they gathered around themselves projected this comprehensive moral vision, which is totally absent now, which is why so many people feel a kind of despair, because they don't see that even in the Great Depression, they projected optimism and hope for people. And it wasn't just a one-syllable slogan to get elected, hope. It was a lot more than that. And, you know, they delivered these huge labor projects that left us so much stuff. There's an economist at Harvard, Ben Friedman, who did a book called The Moral Consequences of Growth. And that's the book in which he says, in his study of economic downturns, almost invariably, there is a sharp move to the right, and the only major exception was the New Deal. And the only answer he can come up with is Roosevelt's personality, and that incredible voice, that speaking voice. You know, he was the great communicator of his time. He knew how to use the medium of radio. Unfortunately, so did Reagan when he came along to exactly opposite purposes.
And in this final clip, Gray answers a question about Harry Truman's inclination to keep the New Deal going.
I don't think he really tried to keep it going. I mean, he was a much more moderate president with none of the kind of vision that the Roosevelts had. I mean, they had a comprehensive moral vision that I think he completely lacked. He'd never worked in settlement houses. He just, and Roosevelt scarcely talked to him. He only found out about the Manhattan Project after Roosevelt was dead. I mean, big surprise. The one thing that really, you know, if Truman had really wanted to do what Roosevelt wanted, he would have brought back the CCC, because that was Roosevelt's baby. He loved it. It was a great project, and he didn't do that. He just, you know, he started cleaning house. Stettinius wanted to go on being the Secretary of State and having been the liaison with the United Nations. Truman got rid of him, got rid of Hopkins. So, but the New Deal does go on. It's got this momentum. I mean, Dick Walker and I have written a paper about that, about, you know, people like Pat Brown, Earl Warren, even Eisenhower to some extent, you know. They were imbued with the idea of the New Deal. Humphrey, Lyndon Johnson, the War on Poverty. So the New Deal sort of has its own momentum that goes into the 60s, and then the reaction sets in when a generation has passed that doesn't remember Roosevelt anymore.
Gray Brecken, historical geographer, founder and project scholar of The Living New Deal, and author of Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin, which is considered a classic in the field of urban studies. I want to thank Chris Carlson of Shaping San Francisco for furnishing audio of this December 2015 event, which has been edited by yours truly. More information about Shaping San Francisco and its public talk series can be found at shapingsf.org as well as foundsf.org. Gray Brecken's website is graybrecken.net. That's graybrecin.net. I'm C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.